Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please support the restoration, the preservation, and the presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma with your donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So, we're in our fourth week or fourth class of this 27 class structured study of mostly lesser known suttas. We started out describing the Buddha's meaning of becoming and the immediacy of authentic Buddhist practice, meaning that the Dhamma is meant to be practiced in life as life unfolds. And that's where concentration and refined mindfulness comes from and is developed for. The next week we looked at what the Buddha awakened to, that it is from ignorance of Four Noble Truths that all manner of confusion, stress and suffering arises. Paticca Samuppada Sutta, the primary sutta on dependent origination. Last class we looked at the Four Noble Truths as the establishment of the entire Buddha's Dhamma. And this week we're going to look at the Eightfold Path. This particular sutta on the Eightfold Path is called the Magavibhanga Sutta, which is an analysis by the Buddha of the Eightfold Path. And what you'll notice here is this Siddhartha Gautama's incredible understanding of the true nature of human reality as it's expressed through Four Noble Truths and this particular path, the only path that a Buddha taught towards awakening, meaning to develop precisely what he had developed, which is his profound understanding of what it means to be a human being in relation to a human being's environment, this ever-changing, impermanent environment. And as I read this, you'll see there's no ambiguity about what the Buddha taught. Really, doing what Siddhartha Gautama did is merely a matter of following the directions of an awakened human being. And it is really just that simple. I know we've all been involved in Buddhist Dhamma practice for quite a long time, most of us. And so we know that it's not easy, but it is simple. When we clear away all of the aversion that we have, the resistance that we have to recognizing and abandoning what the Buddha is teaching here, recognizing and abandoning all wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It's a remarkable sutta in its brevity and its directness. Once a Dhamma practitioner hears and follows this one sutta, awakening is guaranteed. This is what a Buddha taught. I have heard that at one time, the Buddha was staying at Savatthi at Jita's Grove, Anatha Pandika's monastery. There he addressed those assembled. Friends, I will now give you a detailed analysis of the Noble Eightfold Path. Listen mindfully. This is the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. So just to comment on that in the use of the words, obviously these are, this is a translation. It's actually probably hundreds of translations from the original written material, which wasn't written down until about 300 years after the Buddha passed. And I won't get into the authenticity and how we know that this is authentic, but just to make that comment. So we're using the words right, which implies wrong. Many people don't even like to make that distinction, like there's something wrong in recognizing wrong views or recognizing what might be seen as the negative aspects of human life. There's been this push for many, many years now, and it's not just in the last 50 years, it's really since the beginning of humankind, to only see things in a positive light. And if we choose to do that, we are deluding ourselves because it contradicts the First Noble Truth. So by using the words right view, right speech, etc., it's implying an important aspect of the Dhamma to recognize what is wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong mindfulness, wrong meditation. And we're using the words right and wrong to make that clear distinction that many people don't want to face, that there is a choice to be made in life. And the choice in modern Buddhism, this is what we began with our first class on beginning, the choice in Buddhism, not modern Buddhism, the choice in Buddhism is, is it my intention to awaken in this moment? And if I'm holding that in mind and the framework of the Eightfold Path, then this moment is inclined towards awakening. And so we can be mindful of the fact that there's aspects of human life that would be rooted in the wrong aspects of the Eightfold Path. In other words, rooted in wrong view. So the Buddha's Dhamma, the Eightfold Path, is brilliantly put together by an awakened human being to take us from a deluded state that is characterized as wrong views and develop within that mind that is so corrupted by its own views and liberate that mind from its own ignorance through this Eightfold Path. And it begins and ends in right view. It's interesting that the Eightfold Path was not presented as a linear path. In other words, if you start here, start at, say, right meditation, and you end up at right view. But the Buddha's pointing out, in a very subtle way, the whole purpose of the Dhamma, which is to go from wrong view to right view, incorporating these other aspects of the Eightfold Path, which when looked at closely are simply aspects of right view. Let me continue. The Buddha continues, and what is right view? This description of right view is also a description of an awakened, fully mature human being. And what is right view? Knowledge with regard to stress. It makes sense, doesn't it? The Buddha starts out with describing the problem as ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and that first noble truth is, as a result of that ignorance, dukkha occurs, stress and suffering, greed, aversion, and deluded thinking occurs. So developing a Dhamma would necessarily mean knowledge with regard to that process of developing stress and suffering within us. Right view is knowledge with regard to stress, knowledge with regard to the origination of stress, knowledge with regard to the cessation of stress, and knowledge with regards to the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. I always ask this in our classrooms together when we're physically together. Does anyone feel that they can't develop that type of knowledge? And almost everybody said, no, there's no problem. And it is just that straightforward. We all understand this. And now we're going to be given the direction on how to do it. This, friends, is right view. And what is right intention? Right intention is being mindful of the intention to recognize and abandon wrong views. Makes complete sense, doesn't it? And it immediately directs our Dhamma practice to what's occurring right here, right now. Because it's not... The Dhamma is not concerned about conceptual establishments, meaning a good Buddhist is always compassionate, a good Buddhist is always honest, a good Buddhist is always praying to Avalokiteshvara, a good Buddhist is this, a good Buddhist is that. All concepts of what a good Buddha should look like, but nothing to get you there. The Buddha recognized the cruelty of that, of just establishing a picture of what a Buddhist should be. He would often characterize it as saying, putting on robes that don't fit. They're just masking what's underneath this, which is ignorance rooted in wrong views of self in relation to the world. Being mindful of the intention to recognize and abandon those wrong views. That's right intention. So how do I know in this moment if this moment is being orchestrated by my own wrong view? If there's any greed, aversion in that moment, if there's any stress, if there's any eye-making, if there's any grasping, if there's any distracting reaction in my mind in this moment, I'm rooted in wrong view. Because a right view is free of grasping after anything and ultimately grasping after any fabricated notion of self in relation to the world. In other words, an awakened human being has given up the battle of maintaining fake views of self. Buddha continues. Right intention is being mindful of the intention to remain free from ill will. Anybody can do that, can't we? Well, maybe not right at first, but the Dhamma develops that ability. And it's an important focus of Dhamma practice, isn't it? Most classes we end with the Buddha's words on metta. If we're experiencing ill will towards others or towards ourselves, we know that we're rooted in wrong view, and that's as far as we should go with it. In other words, if I'm feeling hatred towards myself or towards another human being, it's not helpful for me to beat the hell out of myself and judge myself from a morally fabricated benchmark. In relation to the Dhamma, I know that if I am engaged in ill will or hatred towards myself or others, or both, it's not because I'm morally bankrupt. It's because I have a wrong view of myself in relation to the world. And that's an important distinction. Because if I think I'm morally bankrupt and that's my problem, then there's no way that my individual intervention can help that, can it? I'm going to need an outside agency. I'm going to need Avalokiteshvara. I'm going to need some type of conceptual establishment outside of my reality as a human being in order to resolve those issues. The Buddha is taking our minds from being focused outside of our body, using jhana meditation to bring it back into our body and look at the reality of that. Right intention, an aspect of right intention, is the intention to remain free from ill will. It's so simple and basic, isn't it? And yet, as a human population, we have been trying to eliminate ill will from our society since the beginning of time. We can't do it, can we? In fact, you might say that we're more rooted in ill will now than we ever have been. I don't think that's true, but you could say that just because of the way the media treats things. But we haven't changed much as a human society. We went through a period that we still call the Age of Enlightenment. And nothing, we didn't become enlightened about anything, did we? We still harbor ill will towards ourselves and others at a very, very basic level. And so that leads us to create these very subtle but powerful strategies that are addressing the problem, but addressing the problem from the point of view of ignorance. It cannot resolve the problem of ill will. As we start developing the Dhamma, in fact, I would bet every one of you noticed this, one of the first things that we have to do is stop judging ourselves harshly. That's why you'll hear me say, excuse me. You'll hear me say so often that the most basic aspect of Dhamma practice is to be gentle with ourselves. And what that means is to be free of ill will towards ourselves and others, and be free of ill will towards our Dhamma practice. To cease judging ourselves harshly in relation to this single path that we're developing, to free ourselves from those harsh judgments. That's what the Buddha is referring to here as well. Excuse me. Being free of ill will is being free of ill will towards ourselves and others. Buddha continues, being mindful of the intention to remain harmless to all beings. It sounds like such a wonderful thing. Why can't we do it? Why do people with the compassionate intention to not be harmful towards themselves or others end up being harmful towards themselves or others? Because we're lacking an understanding of who we are in relation to the world. And that's all it is. It's not too simplistic to say all the ills of humanity are rooted in ignorance of the way humanity is meant to operate. An individual, when they cease taking life personally, stops this whole cascade of events that is rooted in ignorance. Remember, from dependent origination, from ignorance as a requisite condition come fabrications. From those fabricated views, from wrong views, comes all, in the Buddha's words, all manner of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, all manner of suffering. And so again, the focus immediately is back onto right view and the views that I'm holding of myself in relation to the world. The Buddha continues, this, friends, is right intention. And what is right speech? Abstaining from lying, abstaining from divisive speech, abstaining from abusive speech, abstaining from gossip, abstaining from idle chatter. This, friends, is right speech. Now, I want to read these again and relate this to the speech that we have going in our own minds, too, because this ultimately this resolves in the internal dialogue that we're having with ourselves. Abstaining from lying. How often do we lie to ourselves, create these images of ourselves that are rooted in fabrication. As the Buddha would say, they're like foam on the ocean. And yet once we create that fabricated view, false view of self, we're compelled to maintain it, aren't we? To defend it, keep it going in the world. And that's stress. That's the essence of stress. Abandoning, abstaining from divisive speech, especially divisive speech towards myself. Abstaining from abusive speech. Abstaining from gossip doesn't really apply to ourselves, but it's an important thing. If we find ourselves talking about others when they're not in front of us, we know we're doing it as an aspect of ill will and as an aspect of wrong view. And it's not so much that we're creating harm towards the person we're gossiping. We are. But it's to be noticed as an aspect of ignorance and the harm that that's doing to myself, not just to other people. When I teach kids, one of the first ways that I reach children, and of course I don't get into this whole, the whole Dhamma practice, but say a kid of 12 or 14 years old, and I ask them about when you're together with your friend and you're talking about another friend that isn't there, and maybe you say a few things that aren't nice, and I'll ask them, how does that make you feel? And to a kid, they've always said, you know, I don't feel too good when I do that. And the simple answer, and kids always get it, is, well, stop doing it and you'll feel better. And they get it. As adults, we try to justify that behavior. We create these scenarios in mind that people deserve to be belittled a little bit or denigrated. It might be because of their politics or the way they look, or in our society, it could even be skin color or sexual orientation. But we'll always find a justification to denigrate others. But we do it because we think so low of ourselves. It's the only reason we would do this to other people. And again, it comes back to seeing things clearly, seeing myself clearly, to stop judging myself so harshly. Abstaining from idle chatter. That idle chatter, as it relates to ourselves and right speech, is that ongoing story that we cannot seem to control in our own minds. It's jhana meditation that enables us to stop the idle chatter that we have going on in our own minds, but also take that outside of what might be coming up in meditation and recognize the idle chatter that we engage in all the time with our friends and associates. Be mindful of it. Cut back on it a little bit. And today, idle chatter is expressed in so many ways, like Twitter, like Facebook, like the constant need to have the whole world looking in on me and to have me connected with everything. Here's what my cat did this morning. Look at what I ate for breakfast. Why do we need to do that? Why do we work so hard to keep establishing ourselves, entangling ourselves in the world? Because we feel we must. It's because we feel that we're lacking something if we don't do it, if we're not constantly establishing ourselves in the world. What's the opposite of that? What's the opposite of that compulsive need to always have me out there? It's a calm and peaceful mind. It's the cessation of I-making. It's what the Buddha taught Bahia in that wonderful sutta. Continue. This, friends, is right speech. And what is right action? Similar. Abstaining from taking life, abstaining from taking what is not freely given, abstaining from sexual misconduct. This, friends, is right action. There's this one part of this. Abstaining from what is not freely given is so subtle and so powerful, because it's a teaching on how we latch on to other people and take what they're not ready to give us, but we coerce them and manipulate them into giving us parts of themselves that they don't want to. There's a word that we've even developed a phrase for that in our world. It's called taking hostages. And we do this in relationships all the time. And I don't want anybody to get uncomfortable and start judging themselves. Do I do this or do I don't do this? This is just a common human problem. It's a common human condition that we engage in because we're always grasping after more. And we're always grasping after the attachment that we can have to the things of the world. And so we do the same thing with other people. We attach ourselves to other people. We take hostages. We don't take what is freely given. Abstaining from sexual misconduct, just to briefly talk about that. Many people, for some reason, I just remember going through this and being confused by it, that the Buddha somehow implied that in order to awaken, you had to take vows of chastity. The Buddha never said anything like that. He taught that his Dhamma should guide all aspects of behavior, including sexual behavior, which means that in a sexual relationship, we should focus on being generous, just like we do with the rest of it. And that's the key. And think about that. Again, I don't want to get too deep into it because it's uncomfortable for some people to talk about. But think about having a relationship, a sexual relationship, that is based on giving and not taking. It changes everything, doesn't it? Okay, that's as far as I'm going to go with that. This, friends, is right action. And what is right livelihood? Right livelihood abandons dishonest livelihood. Makes sense, doesn't it? Right livelihood is honest livelihood. Again, it makes sense. When I first came across the Eightfold Path and then came across this seventh aspect of the Eightfold Path, right livelihood, I wondered, why is this here? Isn't right livelihood covered by right speech and right action? Until I read a little bit more and realized that what the Buddha noticed and what I noticed in my own business career is that otherwise good and honest men and women, when it took time to put food on a table, would cut some corners. And if we do that in Dhamma practice, we're simply feeding ignorance. And so that's why the Buddha points this out, that even in business, we must practice the same right speech and right action. We must maintain honesty and look to be of service, to be generous even in our business world, in our business lives. This, friends, is right livelihood. And what is right effort? This describes what we do on a moment-by-moment basis within Dhamma practice. Right effort is developing the skillful desire and ongoing desire to avoid unskillful qualities that are not present. It's a lot of words, but it simply means that as we start developing Dhamma practice, we don't substitute other things that will be just as distracting as what we're trying to abandon. Right effort is effort in developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence to abandon unskillful qualities that are present. What are unskillful qualities? Again, it's a lot of words, and we could get a little bit distracted, but what are the unskillful qualities? Wrong speech, wrong action, and wrong livelihood. It's just that, excuse me. These middle components, these moral and ethical components of the Eightfold Path, excuse me, are one of the reasons why the Buddhist teachings are given religious connotations because of the moral aspects. Most all religions, not everyone, but most all religions have a moral and ethical component. But the Buddha wasn't saying that if you just engage in right speech, right action, or right livelihood, you're going to go to Buddhist heaven when you die. He wasn't concerned about any of that. He taught right speech, right action, and right livelihood, moral and ethical qualities, as a way of being mindful of our own level of awareness of who we are in relation to the world. In other words, if we continue to remain rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, it will be expressed as wrong speech, wrong action, and wrong livelihood. And as we begin to be mindful of that, we know where we can apply Dhamma practice. Because if we're constantly being mindful of what's coming out of my mouth, what deeds I'm doing, what actions I'm taking, and how I'm making a living, All of my fabricated views will be expressed in those ways. And so in a very practical way, this is another way of saying the Buddha was concerned about how to live as a human being, not as something extraordinary outside of the human experience. This is what he was concerned about. And almost to a person, not everyone, but most of the people that I teach, at some point they'll start getting that Dhamma practice is really focused on that right speech, right action, right livelihood. And many people begin Dhamma practice with recognizing right speech. Quieting the mind just enough to start realizing what's coming out of my mouth. And as we do that, we're also gaining the ability in meditation and then off our cushions to recognize and abandon fabricated views that are being maintained by the story I'm always telling myself. The story of my life. And that is one of the reasons why the Buddha taught jhana meditation and no other. Because if we engage in another type of, analytical type of meditation, meaning quiet our minds, and then we're often taught, especially in one branch of modern meditation, to quiet your mind and then look into all your thoughts and gain insight into what's going on in your mind. Well, that's just constant distraction, isn't it? And it's reinforcing the story that I've been telling myself my whole life. Once I started teaching this, I was coming across people that were creating great, not everybody's going to do this, but a significant number of people that start a meditation practice without the right framework increase their own psychoses because they have no framework of reference for what they should be abandoning. And so if your focus then is just on what's occurring within your own mind, you can't help but expand it. The Buddha taught to use meditation for the sole purpose of recognizing that process and interrupting it by being mindful of the breath. Jhana meditation. Jhana means concentration. And that's the sole reason why we do this, to interrupt this story in my mind and deepen that concentration that I can take off my cushion and hold in mind these principles that the Buddha is teaching here. Right effort is effort developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence to establish skillful qualities that are not yet present. What skillful qualities? The skillful qualities that we're all talking about right here. The Eightfold Path is the path of right effort. Right effort is effort developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence to end confusion and increase the full development of skillful qualities that are present. Meaning, and you hear me say this often, to recognize in your Dhamma practice that which is bearing fruit and recognize in your life that which is taken away from your Dhamma practice, what is holding you back from awakening. Both of those components are a Dhamma practice, and it's so important that we recognize that. It's not just enough to say or grasp after being a good person or create a conceptual ideal of what I should be as long as I could be a good Buddhist, or for that matter, a good Catholic or a good Muslim or whatever it might be. It's changing the way that I think about myself in relation to the world that brings calm and peace. Not just being a good person. Most human beings are good people, aren't we? But we're lacking an understanding of who we are in relation to the world. So at the very least, we engage in ill will towards ourselves and oftentimes towards others. We create the in the Loka Sutta, karma is the field, consciousness the seed, and craving the moisture. We keep feeding that field of karma by ignorance. And what the only thing that could grow is further ignorance, further greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. But as we engage in the Eightfold Path, we interrupt that process. We interrupt it directly. Continue. And we interrupt it directly through right effort. The Buddha continues. And what is right mindfulness? Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of the body, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful. Abandoning greed and reaction to worldly events. I'm going to read it again. Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of the body free of distraction. Free of distraction. What is the Buddha talking about? He's talking about jhana meditation, isn't he? Because that's the tool he gave us to free ourselves of distraction. Free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful of abandoning greed in reaction to worldly events. Ardent, alert, and mindful. That the Buddha is saying, this is what you focus on. This is what you hold in mind. Abandoning greed in reaction to worldly events. I make it. Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of feelings arising and passing away, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful of abandoning greed in reaction to worldly events. The same thing. Now, the Buddha's talking about the four foundations of mindfulness, isn't he? This is his only reference to mindfulness, is these four foundations of mindfulness, and then as they apply to the Eightfold Path. So in meditation, we've all did this just a few minutes ago. We notice that feelings were arising. We are maintaining the focus to be free of distraction or being distracted by feelings. We are ardent, alert, and mindful of doing just that, and we take a breath. So that simple action of recognizing we're caught up in our thoughts and then taking a breath, bringing our mind back into our body, is following the instructions that the Buddha is giving us right here. Right mindfulness, I'm reading it again. Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of feelings arising and passing away, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful of abandoning greed and reaction to worldly events. He's actually making a statement of what we're doing. So it's even more direct than just a statement of this is what you should do. He's saying this is what you are doing in right meditation, in right mindfulness. Getting to the third factor of the four foundations of mindfulness. Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of mental qualities or thoughts arising and passing away, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful of abandoning greed and reaction to worldly events. So we do that in meditation. Every time we start our meditation, thoughts are rolling around in our head. We're distracted by our thoughts, and we take a simple breath. And at least in that moment, while mindful of my breath, my thoughts, my self-referential thoughts, are interrupted. I am establishing freedom from distraction of my own thoughts. I am free of greed and reaction to worldly events as expressed in my thoughts in that moment. All the power of awakening is in that one breath when it's included within the framework of the Eightfold Path. Outside of the Eightfold Path, meditation is likely just going to reinforce wrong views because there's no framework for recognizing and abandoning wrong views. But within the structure of the Eightfold Path, that simple act of taking the breath, engaging in jhana meditation and interrupting that process, we're following in right effort and developing spaciousness in our own thoughts between what is an entanglement in the world and what is the reality of this current moment. Getting back to our first class, what am I going to become in this moment? Am I going to become further ignorant by being mindful of ignorance, or am I going to become awakened by being mindful of the factors of the Eightfold Path? Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of the quality of mind arising and passing away, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful of abandoning greed and reaction to worldly events. That's the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And the instruction that I give at the end of meditation, notice the quality of mind, be at peace with your mind, is the Buddha's instructions on that fourth foundation of mindfulness. You remember that when we looked at that sutta many times. It's simply a dispassionate look, no matter what the present quality of my mind is. By me insisting that it has to be different is creating tension in that mind. By me accepting the present quality of my mind, even if it's not a peaceful quality of mind, I can learn to accept that to be at peace in this moment with a less than peaceful mind. That's practicing the fourth foundation of mindfulness. And that allows me to live in the world moment by moment without the need for my mind to be any different, to feel any different, to think any different. I can simply be present with life as life unfolds. And that's the ultimate fourth foundation of mindfulness, which is also awakened right view. Or as we talk about in the different levels of jhana meditation, it's a mind resting in equanimity. This, friends, is right mindfulness. And what is right meditation? For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases. The Buddha's first description or primary description, the Buddha's primary description of meditation begins with that. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases. And they withdraw from the need for sensual stimulation. That's every time we take that breath in meditation and even off our cushion when we feel the need to reunite our mind and our body, that's just what we're doing, isn't it? I'm withdrawing my attention from a grasping attention out in the world, what I need in this moment to be happy, to be safe, to acquire whatever I feel I need to be me, to establish me. In that moment, I'm free of all greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases and they withdraw from unskillful mental qualities. The Buddha is describing what we do. As a consequence of deepening jhana meditation, we withdraw from unskillful mental qualities. It's not something that happens by magic. It's a direct result of our Dhamma practice. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases, and they enter and remain in the first jhana, the first level of meditation, of meditative absorption, which is joyful engagement and pleasure in the Dhamma, born with withdrawal and accompanied by directed thought and mindful evaluation. So what does that mean? The first level of jhana, we all experience it every time we meditate. We take a breath, we come into our body, and our thoughts arise. And we directed thought means we direct our thought back to our breath. It simply means that we are now regaining control of our own minds. We direct our thought back to our breath. And the, read the right, the word that I used. Mindful evaluation. And it simply means that I'm now evaluating what's occurring within my own mind, but now from the framework of the Eightfold Path. I'm looking at what's occurring within my own mind from that framework now. That's the first jhana. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases and their directed thoughts and mindful evaluation quiets. It simply means that my connection to my breath is deepening and my concentration is increasing. It doesn't mean it's not a permanent state. As we all know, in meditation, we travel through these four different levels of meditative absorption, and the reason why the Buddha teaches them is to notice that my concentration is increasing. How do I know it? Because for right now, my directed thought and my evaluation of what's occurring has stilled. I now know I've developed the second level of jhana. And usually, as soon as I have that thought, especially in beginning meditation, I'm going to have the next thought is, oh boy, I've done something great. And that's okay. Take a breath and come back to your reunite your mind and your body, because in that moment, you are still established in the first level of jhana and you can continue your meditation. Why am I saying that? Because if you're using some type of open-ended or free-form meditation without that structure, once you get caught up in your thoughts, now you're just caught up in your thoughts, aren't you? And so you could spend hours doing that, thinking or even calling it meditation, when you're not doing anything to increase concentration. You're chasing around your thoughts. You might find some insight as to where your thoughts are coming from, but no useful introspective insight as far as the Buddha teaches Vipassana, insight into the three marks of existence. Let me go back just a little bit. As their concentration increases and their directed thoughts and mindful evaluation quiets, they enter and remain in the second jhana, the second level of meditative absorption, which is joyful engagement and pleasure born of deepening concentration, free from directed thought and mindful evaluation, which simply means we notice that our concentration is increasing and we take skillful joy in that. We recognize, again, it's so important to recognize that this Dhamma practice is actually bearing fruit. The Buddha continues. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases and their joyful engagement fades. So it's not a joyful engagement that's fading and I'm going to feel a sense of loss. It's because I'm deepening my concentration. And so the internal mechanism that would generate the feeling of joy is no longer operating within me. My mind has concentrated to the point where that's no longer part of my experience. Equanimity arises with mindfulness of pleasure and a mind united with a body. They enter the third jhana. The wise know this as equanimous and mindful, a pleasant abiding. The wise know it. It simply means that we recognize the value. This is another way of using that term evaluation. We recognize the value in a quieting mind that's deepening concentration. Why is that so important to recognize the value of that? Because if we don't, we're not going to continue Dhamma practice, are we? Because what we're experiencing in that area between the third, and I'll talk about in a moment, the fourth level of jhana, is the experience of awakening as the Buddha describes it. And it's important to recognize that, yes, we're touching that. In our meditation practice, we are touching what it means to be an awakened, fully mature human being every time we meditate. We're having that experience. It's important to recognize it and not dismiss it as something that we're not good enough to maintain, because that's not the point. It's not about maintaining the third or fourth level of jhana. It's to recognize that our meditation practice is actually increasing concentration. It's bearing fruit. That's enough. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases. Their mind rests in equanimity. Neither pleasure nor pain have a footing here. That's the cessation of grasping. Neither pleasure nor pain have a footing. I'm no longer going to chase anything to make myself feel good. I'm no longer going to chase away anything that I think might take away from my pleasure or my safety or what I need to keep myself established in the world. That's a mind resting in equanimity. That's a mind that is free of self-reference. Their mindfulness and equanimity is pure, free of wrong views. Free of wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. This, monks, is right meditation. So there's no ambiguity there about even meditation, is there? How could we get so confused by all these different meditation practices that we, and I probably tried a couple thousand looking for the right one? Why? Because I didn't follow the Buddha's teaching, but I didn't know it either. Nobody ever taught me this. I spent decades in modern Buddhism without having anybody teach me this, what the Buddha just taught. Nobody. I heard reference to the Eightfold Path and Four Noble Truths. Honestly, I never had one teacher that actually taught this, what the Buddha taught and what the Eightfold Path is. So if nobody taught me that, I'm not blaming other people. It was up to me to find out, and I did. But if nobody taught me an Eightfold Path, how could I expect myself to practice it? I couldn't. But when I read the Buddha's words and I came across this, it became so clear. This is what I do and nothing else. So I started this out by saying, the Buddha awakened and he taught us all to do the same thing through this Eightfold Path. All that we need to do is follow direction. This, monks, is right meditation. This is what the Buddha declared. Those gathered were gratified and delighted at his words. It's the end of the sutta. Thank you for listening today. As we go around, I'd like to hear what you think about my comment about the simplicity and directness of the Eightfold Path and how you find it. We'll start with Ram up in the top right-hand corner, left-hand corner. How are you, Ram?
Unmute that. I'm good. Yeah, that aspect of the whole teaching, that it is simple and clear and direct, definitely comes to your comments. And it is, for me too, the most, that's what kept me here. I've been around enough mystical traditions, very interesting, and it would grab your mind and all that. But in the end, it doesn't lead to any kind of clarity. And this does.
Yeah.
I wrote a little piece last night while I was under the influence of
chocolate.
As a skilled archer, we aim the arrow of the Eightfold Path directly at right view, understanding the Four Noble Truths. To develop right view, we need the eye of right intention, abandon wrong views, ill will, and to remain harmless. The eye of right intentions focuses by living mindfully in right speech, right action, and right livelihood. so that we recognize wrong views, ill will, and harmfulness. Because without recognizing these wrong intentions, we cannot abandon them. The arm pulling back on the bow gets its strength from right effort, skillful desire, and ongoing persistence to avoid and abandon unskillful qualities and develop and increase skillful qualities and end confusion. And you could look around you in the Sangha and you can note the years of ongoing persistence that has shown there. And finally, the archer's feet are solidly planted in right mindfulness and right meditation.
That's great, Ron. Thank you.
Bravo.
Thank you so much. It was really wonderful. Brett, how are you this morning?
I'm good. I've been exposed.
Really?
It was a great teaching, I could definitely see where I have to apply so many things, with the Eightfold Path, and it's so there's so much in there that I can use and that I need to work on, and I think there's a lot of things that I do already that I might not notice that I do. So I think that's just being able to see those things too, I like to read it again and see what I can get more out of it.
Yeah. Thank you, Brett. Yeah, I mean, this is Dhamma practice. This is what it is. Mm-hmm. Lorna, good morning.
Hello, John. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
The Eightfold Path, exactly how I think of what the Eightfold Path is. I think the Eightfold Path is what all our thoughts should be rooted in.
Yeah.
You did mention karma and the seed. The seed is the root of the thought. In life, to understand what something is, you have to understand what it isn't. And I think the Eightfold Path it gives you something to reflect on in your mind to develop a skillful knowledge of if you're thinking in right view or wrong view. And I think the Eightfold Path should be used that way, that it gives you the confidence to develop right view, because you know what wrong, you also learn what wrong view is. Mm-hmm. And for instance, when you're thinking a thought that is not developed by the Eightfold Path, you can see that mentally you're still hanging on to a fabrication. You're not thinking clearly, and you can also, when you're again not thinking in the form of the Eightfold Path, you can also feel it in your body sometimes. For instance, when you're meditating, you can feel that your shoulders are tight or your legs are aching, or you're just not sitting relaxed, or something like that. Well, all that's meaning that you're thinking something away from the Eightfold Path.
Yep.
And you're thinking more in line of you being in a fabrication. Your thoughts are in a fabrication. So these are sort of some examples how I use the Eightfold Path and how I understand that we should use the Eightfold Path within the Buddha teachings. And you spent quite a bit of time on meditation throughout your talk this morning, John, and I think absolutely rightly so, because nothing, if you didn't meditate, you are just too distracted in life to know any of this.
Yep.
To know if you know right view, wrong view, if your internal dialogue is harmful or if it's not, if it's supportive or harmful. That's my hang up, by the way. I'm good at my internal dialogue is not rooted in the Eightfold Path. That's my thing. But anyway, that's how I think of the Eightfold Path. It's the fundamental outline of where your thoughts should spring from, or that's where the seed should come from to develop good karma, et cetera, et cetera. Thank you.
That was brilliant, Lorna. Thank you. I mean, the Eightfold Path is the framework for right mindfulness, and that's what you said. It's designed to change our thinking from wrong view to right view. It doesn't. You described that beautifully. Thank you. Good morning, Becky.
Good morning, John. Good morning, everyone. the Eightfold Path is clear and direct. It's the way to do it. It shows you the way to do this. And the thing that I always found attractive about the Dhamma was that it left the responsibility of doing this up to me.
Yeah.
I'm not placing it in the hands of some god or some prophet. It's up to me. And I feel that really speaks to me. And the right and the Eightfold Path tells me how to do it. But it's not easy. As I've said this before, the Eightfold Path is simple, but it's not easy. It's not easy to realize really who you are in relation to the world.
Yeah.
It's not easy for me. And certainly without this path, there would be no way. No way you could ever do it. But you can begin to see that story in your mind, and you can stop and say, well, this isn't really Eightfold Pathy. This is not. This is a wrong path. Now, at least the recognition part is the first step. And when you can recognize it and you have these clear instructions that tell you how to recognize it, and you can continue and take the second step. But like I said, I've been at this for quite a while and it's not easy, but it's the only thing you can do is just keep practicing.
Yeah.
It's that right effort. Just make sure that you continue with that right effort and you continue to meditate, like Lorna said, and eventually you'll have more auspicious days.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you, Becky. I used to say it more than I say it now, but the Eightfold Path is a path of, or a practice of ease and joy, but it's not for the faint of heart.
That's right.
Thanks, Becky. Good morning, Jen.
Thank you.
Hi, good morning, John. Good morning, everyone. This is, well, first I want to say, Ron, that was awesome.
Yeah.
Love it. Influence of chocolate is working for you. The this sutta, I thought, was really clear. It was very straightforward. I thought it really just clearly kind of laid everything out. And you're just to go back to the question that you asked in regards to your commentary on it. You really come at it from a lot of different ways. Like you broke out almost every line of that sutta and kind of related to it in this way and kind of related to it in that way and related to it in this way and all sort of ways that are kind of cutting through lots of different kinds of conditioned thinking.
Yeah.
Hopefully, you know, relating to a lot of different ways people might, you know, arbitrarily and not at all important fabricate. But, you know, it's getting through that fabrication.
Yeah.
That's valuable as you as teacher to all of us. So thank you. And happy to be here.
Thank you, Jen. As we develop the Dhamma, there's a word that people use about the quality of mind that's developed in meditation. One word that's often applied is spaciousness, that we're developing spaciousness. Through jhana meditation in the Eightfold Path, we really are, because what's occurring is we're clearing out our minds of all the things that we've been clinging to as self-reference. And as we develop the Dhamma, we really do create more space. And as those fabricated views of ourselves are diminished, there is space to actually see reality. And what we're doing, and Becky mentioned recognizing, as we recognize our fabrications and then take the second step of abandoning those fabrications, we're actually making room for ourselves in the world because we're letting go of the things that we're not. And now, when the Buddha is describing a mind resting in equanimity, it's a mind that is, as we said in our very first retreat, it's a mind that is empty of ignorance. Ignorance fills up the mind with ignorant stuff. But as we awaken, we let go of all that. And that's the practical description of a pure mind resting in equanimity is pure because it's not defiled by ignorance. So thank you for bringing that up. I'm not sure who this is. Liz, how are you?
Hi. This is my first time I joined these.
I'm sorry. I thought this was that. Is this Lou talking now?
Yeah, you. Oh, sorry.
Good. How are you, Lou?
All good. Thank you. As I said, it's the first time I joined, and I enjoy it. Very good explanation. Very clear and straightforward on the Eight Noble Path, and already about the Eight Noble Truth, but. You explain in a different way, and it's very linked to the jhana meditation. So I like a lot. Yeah, thank you very much.
Good. I'm glad you joined us, Lou. Please join us again. Now, Liz, how are you, Liz?
I'm doing well. I'm just so grateful to have. The Dhamma right now during this time of stillness of sitting still, because it gives me a lot more time to really reflect on the teachings in a way that I wouldn't have been able to do if I had been distracted with my former busy life. So I'm really grateful for this time. I really liked what Lorna said and what Ram said. I guess I'll have to eat more chocolate.
Especially Anita's, Ram's wife.
That's right. You're taking it from the source there.
How are you?
So thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'm glad you joined us. Liz, I just want to, do you see Bonnie or talk to her?
I do.
She's doing well?
Yep, she's resigned from teaching, and she's looking forward to developing her practice and doing some teaching on her own. So
please tell her I said hello. We all said hello to her. Defane, good to see you.
Yes, hello, hello. Nice to see you guys.
How are you?
Good, good, good. Yeah, you're as usual. You elucidate wonderfully. Of course. I definitely had two comments. One, I think that Lorna said, you know, what it is and what it is not, definitely resonated with me. I think, like, you know, me and my conversations with people about Buddhism, the right and wrong kind of languaging, I guess people really attach to a religious command, like a morality, and people really, I mean, it's something which in the Buddhist world, people really look to him as being omniscient in some sects and omnipotent. So seeing, you know, right action, right intention, this is like, you know, coming from a god or one of the gods, that's the Buddha.
Yeah.
Of course, we know that. We know better than that.
Yeah, and that's why it's so important to really understand who the Buddha was and what he taught, that he didn't teach any of that. Mm-hmm. Or you will take this as a moral teaching, like the Ten Commandments might be.
Exactly. The one thing that really that when I think of it, you know, from your class and perspective, the right and wrong is when you do something wrong, there is a consequence, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's also learning. That's why when Lorna talked about what it is, what it is not, you know, it's sometimes you have to, and for me, that's the importance of mindful practice, of getting to the what is not and feeling deeply the suffering when you go down that, the unskillfulness, and allow the practice to kind of teach you that is the unskillful route. Because it's one thing to understand it, because I think a lot of times when I have conversations with people about Buddhism and the practice, it gets very heady and almost philosophical. But there is definitely an emotional import to it, that when you get to almost like hitting rock bottom, like AA type of thing, where you get to that really deep understanding from the emotional, visceral level, that what you're doing is causing you suffering. And that's when you really begin to get serious about practicing, wanting to change. So, and that, for me, that's what's wrapped up in right intention. I want you to, if you could, talk a little bit more about that.
Well, thank you, Defane. I mean, it's the key component of the Dhamma. It's one of the reasons why I started this particular study with the three suttas on three suttas that are on the meaning of becoming, because that's what this is about. And there's nothing magical, mystical, esoteric about anything the Buddha taught. It's simply practical instructions on how to be a human being. And when we see when we want to make a human being omniscient, like most people do with, you know, our friend Siddhartha, we lose everything, because he wasn't. The essence, in fact, I'll be putting up an article in a week or two about the reason why the Buddha didn't teach a religion is just that. There's nothing impractical about what the Buddha taught. And the Eightfold Path, and especially this description of it, is a clear example of that. You know, there's not one thing the Buddha ever taught that would take a person outside of their body for any reason. It really is all about understanding what it means to be a human being, and to develop a meaningful human life by actually living that life and not living some fabricated view of who you think you are.
So I have one more comment question. When you talked about sexual misconduct, I don't know. When I look at, you know, the suttas and teachings, especially the Vinayana, where the Buddha is giving so many rules to his monks about what they should do and what they shouldn't do. I mean, it gets to a point where I remember reading some stories where the monks were like, you know, I'm only a graphic, but let's say enjoying themselves with fruit. We'll just keep it like that. And the Buddha had to make a rule. You know, you can't do that. I can imagine him saying, why do I have to make these rules? But I have to make these rules. So it's interesting. One of the things that one teacher was telling me, well, what one teacher was kind of, we was talking about is, you know, the Buddha is an ascetic. And his practice comes from the ascetic.
Whoever said that again, Brett? I'm sorry. The thing?
Well, that the Buddha had comes from an ascetic line, ascetic lifestyle, you know, Shamanist lifestyle. And I know that there are some commentators today that you know, want to, has, you know, universalized that it's for laity and monks, which I completely get and you know, definitely agree with. But I do see a very ascetic kind of lifestyle when you join his sangha and has the rule structure. So what's your kind of point of view between the laity and the monkhood back in the Buddhist time and how we navigate that today?
Yeah, boy, great question, and thank you for it. There's two components of it. I hope I address them both. The Vinaya is a third book in the Pali Canon that is rules for living within a spiritual community, the original Sangha. And so the Buddha noticed that there were difficulties arising from sexual urges. So he made some rules around that. But he never taught in any way that people should engage in chastity except within that committed community. And he never taught in any way that, how do I say this, that sexual relations are anything different than other human relations. In other words, the same rules apply to our sexual relations. So within a spiritual community, I might make a commitment to remain celibate, but I do that to simplify my life, not because there's something bad about having sex with someone. There's another component about it. And so I guess what I'm saying about that is the Buddha taught sexuality the same as he taught everything else, to have it framed by the Eightfold Path. There was something else you brought up that I wanted to touch on, but I can't remember what it was now.
Was it laity and...
Well, yeah, so he never taught that people in general should not engage in sex. That wouldn't make any sense anyway, would it? He just taught to incorporate the Eightfold Path, but there was something else you brought up that I can't remember.
John, can I throw something in here?
Yes, please.
These rules for chastity have a relation to right action and right speech, as well as that they force the monk to view his those desires, to understand them, and if you indulge in them, that gets you to some point. But if you are told to completely abandon sexuality, you will start to see even the slightest form of sexual desire that comes up in you. And it is it's actually a help in understanding this clinging to sensual stimuli that we have.
Well, yeah, again, as an aspect of the Eightfold Path, it's the minimizing of eye making. When you get into a sexual relationship, that's often epitomized by eye making, isn't it? So the Buddha made an important distinction, and it's part of becoming, between sensuality and sensitivity. That's two different things, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So chasing after satiating my own sensual desires is going to result in less than satisfying sexual relationships, isn't it? But when I'm engaging in a sexual relationship from sensitivity, that's something completely different, isn't it? And it's right. It's that sensitivity that is developed through concentration and right mindfulness and the framework of the Eightfold Path, because now I've freed myself of my own need for sensual gratification, and I can be mindful of being generous and mindfully present. And it's like watching an awakened person driving a car. How do you know he's awakened? Well, how do you know an awakened person is engaging in a sexual act? You don't. The partners might know, they might be appreciative of each other, but it's just an aspect of humanity. So it shouldn't be seen as anything, our sexual relationship shouldn't be seen as anything separate from anything else we're doing. And really, that's the point. And I think that's the Buddha's point, too. Don't make such a big deal over it. Be nice to each other. That's all. Do you have any other questions? You really brought up, you always bring up some great points. It's good to see you this morning. Who's right there? Kevin, how are you?
Very well, Don.
Good to see you.
Good to see everybody. Commentary today is so deep and so rich. Just incredible to listen to everyone.
Yeah.
I think Dom's poetic description was beautiful. And I think it's more than the influence of chocolate. It's really the influence of the Dhamma that helped him produce that.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. Good to see you, my friend.
Really, the Eightfold Path, you know, really is the middle way. And the Thane referred to this. It's midway between complete self-denial and asceticism,
yep,
and complete self-indulgence. And this teaching is simple and direct, and it's practical. It's a roadmap that says, this is what you do, and it's so simple, just do. And of course, it's not for the faint of heart, but it is so direct.
Yeah.
And it's really the essence of the Dhamma. It will lead to awakening for any meditator or follower or bhikkhu or bhikkhuni who follows it. And I hope to see one day that among us will awaken.
Yeah. Thank you, Kevin. It's beautiful.
Thank you, John.
Something you said reminded me about something that the Thane said, and about the Buddha being an ascetic. And I'm not calling you out on this, the Thane, but it's important to note that the Buddha rejected asceticism completely, because it's something that he practiced and found painful and not leading to the goal. What he did was live a very, very simple life, free of desire, that would create the need for asceticism. In other words, if you're not craving after anything, asceticism is defined by deprivation. If you're not craving for something, there's nothing you can possibly deprive yourself of, because you don't need it. You don't want it. You're not after it. So it's very, very simple life. And I would bet that all of us, as we look back at our developing Dhamma practice, would say that our lives are becoming simpler, just as a consequence, a natural consequence of Dhamma practice. Thank you, Kevin. Tim, how are you?
Okay.
Good to see you this morning.
Yes, good morning, everybody. So I'm at a bit of a crossroad, and I don't really know where to begin, but I have started to write you a letter, John. I haven't sent it yet.
Mm-hmm.
I need to work on it. But, and it does, it relates directly to what we're talking about today. You know, there's a lot of conflicting things coming from the Sangha and from the teachings that I've been noticing, and it's all about context, and it could also be from my interpretation. You know, some people are saying it's simple, clear, and direct. Some people say it's difficult. And when I was reading the sutta, I wrote down, and when I was writing the letter that I haven't sent to you yet, I wrote down, what is needed for awakening?
What is what?
What is needed for awakening? And in the sutta, you know, it's not just knowledge. It's not just understanding. It's not all these simple things. I wrote this down, and again, I got to work. It's a work in progress. But I wrote down recognition of wrong view, knowledge of the Dhamma, understanding of the Dhamma, acceptance of the Dhamma, application of the Eightfold Path, especially meditation, and sustaining of right view. Mm-hmm. In parentheses, remaining dispassionate and disenchanted of all impermanence. I am stuck in concrete on the acceptance of the Dhamma. So without that, I can understand, I can recognize, I can know, but if I can't accept, you know, I said many times in class, and it's interesting that I understand this, but I cannot accept it, that all suffering, delusion, and despair is a result of the self, not self, craving that which is impermanent to be permanent. I can't accept that. And until I can accept that, I can't go any further.
All right, would you say that again, that what you can't accept? Because I must have missed something there.
All suffering, delusion, and despair is a result of the self, not self, craving that which is impermanent be permanent.
Oh, and you're saying you can't accept that?
Can't accept that. I can't. I understand it. And so in a way, and I'll write you this down. I mean, I am, you know, it's kind of like you once told me that sometimes that I'm at one of two minds right now, mm-hmm. where I have the mind of understanding what I'm reading makes so much sense. The Sangha's discussion makes so much sense. But yet, when I'm in the thick of living, those impermanent phenomena, the acceptance of it is there's a resistance of that. Now, I'm not asking for answers, and I need to work it out because it's introspective, but I wanted to be honest with the Sangha. So I am basically wanting things to be different from what they are. You know, that's, you know, this.
Including
this,
the Dhamma.
Yes. Yes. So that's kind of the, you know, conflict that I'm experiencing right now. And a lot of it has to do with the environment that we live in right now. I'm sure a lot of it has to do with that because everybody's experiencing this thing differently than others. So, you know, I don't want to parse out the sutta. You know, everybody has certain things that they get out of a sutta. I'm trying to look at the Dhamma as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of where I am. And I'll see if I can finish this letter, John, and get it over to you.
I look forward to it.
But right now, I will be honest with the Sangha. I'm stuck. There's a sense of agitation because I do want things to be different from what they are. But I do appreciate everybody's input and support.
Yeah. Thank you, Tim. I look forward to that letter. That is the difficulty of the Dhamma, isn't it? Is accepting it, because it challenges every one of our fabricated beliefs about ourselves and the world we live in. And so if we're clinging to that at all, we're always going to find difficulty in the Dhamma, but that's Dhamma practice, you know. And it's the reason why nothing is taken on faith in the Dhamma. It's the reason why we actually have to continue to develop the Dhamma, work through the issues that that Tim is talking about. I bet you every one of you, I'll ask any of you in general if you want to just talk about it. Have you felt stuck in your Dhamma practice at any point?
Yeah, I was going to say many, many times.
Definitely.
Yeah. Same here, yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're not alone, Tim. And again, I'm not...
Absolutely.
It's part of Dhamma practice to either continue or not. You know, again, this is an interesting aspect of how the Buddha taught, and he wasn't teaching a religion. In other words, there's nothing at all to compel us to Dhamma practice except if we want to. It's not right or wrong. You know, there's no moral greatness to practice the Dhamma. I'm not a better human being because I'm a Dhamma practitioner. I'm a Dhamma practitioner because it makes sense. It works for me. It's changed my life from a less than satisfying experience to a very meaningful life, but it was a process that we all have to go through to do it, and to question it, and to be have the courage to talk about our struggles is really remarkable. So thank you, Tim. I mean, this is what a sangha is for. So you brought it up in the right place, Tim. I look forward to your letter. And, you know, this is what we
do. Do you mind if I make a comment, John?
Please, anybody, please.
So I just was listening to something that you said, Tim, and it was that you have recognized that you're resisting certain things with regard to the Dhamma and probably just generally some types of impermanence that you're noticing that you're resisting them. And I might be wrong about this, but I kind of got the sense that it was like you were noticing you're resisting it and that the solution to that is now I have to accept it. And I feel like there's an action there of acceptance that we kind of grasp after, or I have to accept this. And I feel like another kind of approach is just recognizing that I'm resisting it. And working towards abandoning that resistance, working towards returning my mindfulness to the breath in the body, feelings arising, thoughts arising, and overall mindfulness, so that we're not trying to get acceptance, we're just recognizing our resistance to something and working towards abandoning that resistance. Just I don't know if that helps, but.
That's great, Jen. Thank you. Anybody else want to talk about the right effort that gets you past being stuck? Tim used a good word, being stuck in concrete.
Yeah. That for me, it's it kind of piggybacks on what she's talking about. This my movement through life employing the Dharma is one, and then which is why I like the analogy of him being a doctor. It's very much an empirical affair, and rather than the quote-unquote abandonment comes not from I need to abandon it. It's like, you know, you're learning how reality works, and you don't want to go against reality. And so, from your own common sense employment, you do that, and it's very much from a reality validating space, rather than from something that's coming up from your own mind, fabricating, constructing what is or is not, or what I shouldn't man. It's like reality saying, you know, you throw a ball up, the ball's going to come down. It gets to that level of empirical validation. He says, okay, well, then I'm going to do it. So reading through, you know, like, for example, through your own navigation, I think, like, all life is suffering. And just like, you know, goodness. just as John was saying, you know, it doesn't say that. When you look at the suttas, it doesn't say that. He said, you know, there's birth is stressful, disease is stressful, life is stressful, and so forth. Or to say that, you know, the Buddha is teaching about a whole lot of things, when the Buddha's like, no, my area of interest is suffering and how to end it. That's my particular, very narrow interest area. I don't talk about any of this metaphysical stuff or things outside of that realm a lot. That's not my area of concern, because my concern is how to become liberated. So for me, reading and employing and testing and seeing what the Buddha's saying and employing it, one begins to navigate towards an understanding rather than. So for me, I would just say hang in there and enjoy the ride towards your own clarity. That's just my advice.
All right. Thank you, Dathane. Great. Happy June. How are you, Laura?
I'm good, thank you.
It's good to see you.
Good to see everyone, and everything that everyone shared is, you know, so enriching, and always filled with such gratitude to be a part of this Sangha. You know, just going back to what you asked, John, about, you know, what we thought about your comments on this sutta and the simplicity of the sutta, I would say that, and everyone else is kind of has mentioned this, that it is kind of laid out really straightforward, and you break it apart, in these ways that you can understand in the way that you move through your day and your actions and intentions and how it's brought back to kind of the right view. And that right view is really bringing everything in the context of the Eightfold Path. And, I was just thinking about my day-to-day these days, and, I have all these to-do lists, and what arises in me when I'm looking at my to-do list and recognizing that there's all manner of clinging and cravings to, getting these things done or feeling a certain way about the state of affairs in the world, and which is constantly taking you out of the moment, right? So
yeah,
I feel like I the Eightfold Path, the simplicity of it is really putting, like, that's your to-do list, it's in there at every turn, and you start your morning with your meditation, and so that it's I think that's the simplicity of it, and that you spoke to that and others have spoken to that. That's where you're going when you feel that resistance or that need to do something else other than, because it brings you right in, and like you said, John, then there's that space for this true experience of what the nature you are in reality, this human experience. So it doesn't make it easy, the simplicity doesn't make it an easy thing to do, because we're human beings. Yep. Human beings are complicated because we've tied ourselves up,
yep,
in a thicket of views and this and that. So, it's just a beautiful thing. The Sangha is a beautiful thing. The way you've brought these teachings is a beautiful thing. It's really moving. It really truly is. Every time I come to class, and when I'm not in class and I'm brought into right view, I'm truly moved. How powerful it is, and how every little bit that we can do to stay on this path is just going, is really the essence of giving back. And helping others in the world. So, John, thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura. Thanks for your kind words and for joining us. And say hello to all the Branhams.
I will.
Karen, how are you this morning? Wait.
Hi, everybody. There you are.
Good morning, Karen.
Good morning. I just want to thank everybody for your comments. It's been such an interesting session today, particularly. And John, you just really clarified in my mind the steps, so to speak.
Yeah. It's a good
really
way to say it.
That. Yeah. I mean, it just really became very clear to me. And I also, what your idea or your comment on spaciousness really also resonated for me, because I've noticed, of course, that when I'm finding myself in stressful situations, what happens is I not only contract physically,
yeah,
but I contract mentally and emotionally.
Yeah.
And when I'm practicing, whether it be yoga or meditation or some other type of spiritual practice, the shift is an expansion, it's a spaciousness.
Yeah.
And it's such a gift. And I wanted to share, I had an experience, it's probably almost 20 years ago, right? At this point, maybe 15, where I was faced with a situation. I was very angry, very, very angry at my partner, and I didn't know really what to do about it, except I went out on my lawn and sat in my Adirondack chair, and I just started to pray, please help me see the situation differently, you know, right view. Please help me see the situation differently, just over and over and over again, probably for, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes. And what happened was the most incredible experience of my lifetime, which is that I was literally struck, and I don't know what other word to use for it. I was literally struck with a sense of complete, an experience and sense of complete and utter love. Nothing else, just love. And it was overwhelming to me because I'd never had that experience before and haven't had it since. And all I could feel at that point was openness, spaciousness, love, and whatever was bothering me, upsetting me, was completely lifted. Wow. Never discussed again, never had an argument about it again, just was able to walk back in the house and just put my arms around this person, and it was gone. And I think, I know that that's where this practice takes us. I'm sure of it. So thanks so much for everybody being here today.
And thank you, Karen, for joining with us too this morning. It was a remarkable class. Did I get everyone? Everyone had a chance? Okay.
Mary.
Mary. Where's Mary? Oh, there's Mary. Hello, Mary.
I'm here.
Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. This is such an important sutta. It covers the territory. It's like a GPS. I love what Laura said, that this is your to-do list. You know, as mothers and as people who care for a home or, you know, have a family, I can imagine for Laura, her to-do list probably feels really big every day. And how, what a release to be able to say, this is my to-do list, the Eightfold Path is, and that's how you take care of yourself before you can turn around and take care of your family and other people. So I appreciate you sharing that, Laura. That really resonated with me. But I do feel that the Eightfold Path is our GPS, that every day, you know, we get up and in every moment we can go sort of left or right. We can do this or don't do that.
Yep.
And as we're navigating that, there are pauses and moments where we have to recognize that we have right view, or we have to recognize we're having wrong view. And by slowing it all down in the spaciousness that Karen mentioned, we have the ability to not react and to react in a much more skillful way.
Yeah.
And when hepasika comes, is we have to recognize when we are experiencing equanimity, when we are experiencing clarity, as much as we need to recognize when we're not.
Yeah.
And all of that is guided by and reinforced by the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths and the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And without going through each of the Eightfold Path, it really comes back to the right effort of your practice, improving your concentration on the cushion with the intention to improve your concentration, which is the opposite of distraction, in your daily life, in your interactions with people, how you organize your life, how you organize that to-do list, how you approach people, whether it's by phone or, you know, however you're operating in your life in these conditions right now. But it really is in every moment recognizing what is and what is not.
Yep.
And that is the essence of who we are and how we interact with the world, is once we strip away these fabrications and views, what's left is us. is who we are.
Yeah.
And the Eightfold Path is just a beautiful guide to know that we're never off the path. I know, Tim, you may feel stuck, but you are so absolutely clearly still on the path because you're here. And you're putting in right effort, which guarantees that you will get unstuck. And we've all been there. So it really is all about staying on the Eightfold Path, knowing that as long as your heart's in it, you're on the path, and coming back to the four foundations of mindfulness, and which includes right meditation. So it's a really wonderful class, a lot of great comments. So thank you, John, for the teaching.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you. That what Laura said about looking at the Eightfold Path as our Buddhist to-do list, that's beautiful, because that's what it is. You know, that's what we do. All right, it's a two-hour class. Sorry about that, folks. I try to get them done a little shorter than that. But what a remarkable class, and the comments are... it's really remarkable how, as a Sangha, we've developed the Dhamma to such a deep level. Any other questions or comments? All right, we'll finish with metta as we always do. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you, John.
Thank
bye, everybody.
You. Thank you.
Bye-bye,
everybody.
See ya.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.